Hi, this is Scott Wilkinson, host of Home Theater Geeks. In episode 169, I chat with Andrew Jones about his new speaker bar that he designed for Pioneer Electronics. So stay tuned.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Home Theater Geeks is provided by CashFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Home Theater Geeks with Scott Wilkinson, recorded August 5th, 2013, episode 169, The Art of the Speaker Bar. This episode of Home Theater Geeks is brought to you by Ting.com. Ting is a mobile phone service that makes sense. Save money with Ting. Pay for what you use, doesn't require a contract, and offers unlimited devices on one pooled plan. To save $25 on your first Ting device, visit htg.ting.com. That's htg.ting.com. And by ProXPN. ProXPN is a virtual private network that allows you to use the internet the way it should be, anonymous and unfiltered. For 20% off your new account, go to proxpn.com/twit and use the code HTG. Hey there, Scott Wilkinson here, the home theater geek and director of content at avsforum.com. This week's guest geek is Andrew Jones, director of loudspeaker engineering at Pioneer Electronics and TAD Laboratories, to talk about his new soundbar. Hey, Andrew, welcome back to the show.
Hi, thank you. Good to be back.
For those of you who are watching live at live.twit.tv or logged into the chat room at irc.twit.tv, can post questions for Andrew as we go along, and I'll pass along as many as I can. So, Andrew, we're here to talk about the new Pioneer soundbar. I believe the model is SP-SB23W. Have I got that right?
You have. I couldn't even remember when I just in my instructional videos. It's the usual thing. I can't remember that model name. I'll just call it the speaker bar.
Oh, yes. Pioneer's model numbers, some model numbers you wonder about. And go, what the heck does that mean? But Pioneers actually, I think, mean something. SP for speaker. SB for speaker bar.
23 and, is the series. W is, right. I think, the finish. Black. That's
black.
Okay. Or something like that.
Something like that. Usually, like that. Pioneers receiver, black receivers are usually with a K, but we'll let that one slide.
Oh, now, wood, maybe.
Oh, yeah, maybe. Yeah, because this does have a wood finish, and we're going to get into that. Yeah. But first of all, I am intrigued by the fact that you used the term speaker bar. Almost everybody in the world calls these things sound bars, but there's a reason why Pioneer doesn't. Why is that?
Well, there's two reasons. One is trying to emphasize the speaker part of it rather than it's not a TV bar. It's not trying to just make sound better than a regular TV. It's trying to make sound as good as a regular stereo system, hence the equivalent of being speakers in a bar. But also speaker bar is actually, sound bar is trademarked. And officially, we're not allowed to use it. And here at Pioneer, we're sticklers for the legalities of what we can and can't do. So we had to come up with a new name, and speaker bar seemed very fitting.
Wow. I'm amazed that somebody has copyrighted or trademarked the term sound bar because everybody uses it.
Everybody uses it, but we decided we shouldn't.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Discretion is the better part of valor, I'm sure, when it comes to legal matters.
Absolutely.
but I guess it's become almost a term like Kleenex or Xerox.
Or Tannoy system, as I see the Tannoy speakers behind you.
Yes. In England, is it true that speakers are often called Tannoys?
Not speakers, but public announcement type speakers in railway systems or railway yards and whatever. It's the Tannoy.
So kidding. Generic. Wow. I didn't realize that. Well, that's, there you go. So a lot of people use... Geo Yakult is asking, who trademarked that term? Do you know?
I don't remember offhand. We did the research, and it's somebody who's not actually using it themselves. I guess they have intention to, but they still own it. And, you know, I guess maybe we could have gone to them and say, look, do you really want to keep using it, or petition to say it's not being used, therefore it's not valid? But we thought, it's not worth it. Let's just call it a speaker bar. It has just as much, although it's not as generic, it has just as much meaning as soundbar. It's a speaker bar. So, therefore.
Yeah. Well, that leads me to my next question, which is, what was your design philosophy behind this? First of all, why make a speaker bar at all with that market being pretty crowded as it is?
The market is crowded, but mostly at the lower price points. And as I said earlier, most are kind of TV bars. You know, in the old days, we had the big rear projection TVs. I know them well because the Pioneer factory out in Chino used to build them. And you'd got room for decent speakers in there. Then as TVs got thinner and thinner and thinner, so did the sound.
Yes.
Seemed quite literal, really. And it's been squeezed so much, the sound's squeezed out of any opening, any gap that they can find around the TV, and sounds terrible. So therefore, there was a need to get better sound from the TV. And unfortunately, that's all that tends to happen in the entry-level market. It's the usual thing. Oh, it makes sound. That must be good enough. And, oh, it's better than the TV. Well, that was a pretty low bar to go in the first place.
Speaking of bars, yes.
Speaking of bars, yes. So it's also at that these kind of price points, you know, let's say below $500, it's a very fast-growing market sector. And I think partly because, yes, we make receivers and obviously we make speakers to do multi-channel systems, but it gets complicated. And a lot of people at the low price points don't want that complication. So we wanted a simple solution. And I say simple solution in particular because I think it was about 13 years ago, just after I joined Pioneer, we released a product called Simple Solutions, which was a soundbar with a subwoofer. And it also gave, you know, the kind of surround sound effects from it. Mm-hmm. And we introduced this as a category. Unfortunately, we were about 13 years too early.
Too early. Ahead of your time.
What to do with it? You know, they kind of put it on the shelf, but where does it go? Does it go in the TV section? Does it go in the hi-fi section? Nobody knew. And so it didn't actually make any inroads. But you know, we were one of the first, if not the first, in that category. Well, now is the time to resurrect that and do something new. And in terms of being a speaker bar, I wanted to not just make something better than TV sound, but given the success we've had of the other speakers that we've done, the Bookshelf and the Towers, I wanted a sound quality that was commensurate with what I'd done there, both in terms of, let's say, the value, but also the overall sound quality. I wanted to be close in character to what I get with those Bookshelves driven by a decent amplifier. So that was my starting point. Can I match that in a sound system?
Well, you certainly did an incredible job with the Bookshelves and the Towers that we have now heard for, what, they're in their second generation, so they've been out for more than a year, right?
The second generation's been out, I guess, for nearly a year.
Overall, oh, yeah.
Been going for nearly 3 years, 2.5 years.
So, and they're so highly regarded by everybody who hears them, including me, that actually I think they do set kind of a high bar, if you will. You've done such a great job with those speakers. How did you manage to get the sound quality close to that in a speaker bar, which is by necessity a very different form factor? You know, it's a long, skinny thing that you sit in front of the TV, much different cabinet shape than actual speakers. Tell us a little bit about the design philosophy, how you approached this problem.
But I approached it by worrying a lot and panicking a lot. Can I actually make something that matches that character? But of course, starting with the drive units are always the heart of a speaker system. And since I'd developed the drive units for the bookshelves, I took basically the work that I'd done on those, the second generation, and transferred it to the speaker bar. So the tweeter is essentially the same, except that the magnet was so big in the tweeter on the bookshelf that I had to change to a neodymium magnet just to kind of get it through its own hole, because, of course, the width of the baffle had shrunk down for the speaker bar. Mm-hmm. And then the bass driver, which was a 4-inch in the bookshelf, I made into a 3-inch. But I've got two of them. So area-wise, I'm about equal. And then...
Oh, in terms of the area of the vibrating surface.
Yes. Now, of course, the excursion isn't quite as much in capability as with the bookshelf. But the speaker bar comes with a subwoofer. And I managed to engineer enough excursion, doing the same things as I did with the bookshelf, of getting a reasonable long throw from the voice coil magnet assembly, venting the pole piece, just making it clean so that you could let the air breathe out of the drive unit. But then by putting in a high-pass filter to cross over to the subwoofer, you cut out all the extreme low frequencies. So now those drive units don't have to move as far because they're handing over to a subwoofer. But the trick is getting them to go down low enough to the typical crossover points that you might employ with a subwoofer so that you don't get any audible separation between the speaker bar and the subwoofer. Mostly, with small low-cost products and these tiny little drive units that are used in some of the soundbars, the crossover point might be as high as 200, 250 hertz. You don't get a seamless blend to the subwoofer that way.
Right.
And so that was the goal of designing the drive units sufficiently well that they could go down low enough. And I cross over about 110 hertz. So that's typical territory for a subwoofer for getting a reasonably seamless blend.
Now, THX typically recommends a crossover at 80 hertz. So you're a little above that, but not too much.
I'm a little above. The typical range you'll see in most receivers, they'll go from, let's say, 50 up to 120. So I'm towards
And you can choose which crossover you want.
Yeah. Yes. Now, of course, with a product like this, you don't choose. I choose. That's my job.
Right.
That was always the difficulty with subsat systems. One of the most difficult things to do is blend the bass to the mid-bass, and yet we hand that over to the end user, and it's not that easy to play around and get it right. So with this product, of course, there's no adjustment there. The subwoofer is what it is. It's blended to the speaker bar, and I've done that work.
Yeah.
I couldn't take it all the way down to 80 because it's always a compromise. The lower you go, for every octave down you go, you need 4 times the excursion. So... and or you need extra power to drive those speaker units. So everything would be limiting the sound level capability of the total system if I'd have tried to transition at such a low frequency.
Mm-hmm. And how did you... I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, I talk too much maybe, but...
No.
One of the things I wanted to make sure is, again, a lot of the soundbars in this category, they don't really play very loud. Yes, they play louder than the TV, but they don't match the capability of a typical stereo system. So once again, I wanted to make sure it can play loud so you can really get the dynamics of the music or the movies coming through the system. And so, yes, I played around with how low can I take the crossover point, how can I engineer the drivers, what power have I got available from the internal amplifiers to each of the drive units, and just optimize all of those to get the right transition and the right dynamics out of the system.
Now, when you optimize the larger driver, not the tweeter, but the larger 3-inch driver, you tried to get that down so that it plays reliably down to 110 hertz.
Yes.
And some of that was in the driver design, but how does the... enclosure relate to that? Is it a sealed enclosure, for example, or is it ported?
It is actually a sealed enclosure. At these kind of frequencies, it wouldn't really work to vent it. And in fact, when you're talking about small speakers, the smaller you go, the more difficult it is to actually vent a loudspeaker cabinet without getting noise through the vents, particularly with small subwoofers. So that's the other thing I didn't want to try and do, to try and extend the speaker bar so low that it would either require venting just to get enough overall system sensitivity and extension out of it, but then suffer noises from the vent. And I've heard that through too many small systems. So closed box, make sure that the crossover point or the crossover slopes are high enough that you really exclude all the low bass out of it, and engineer the amplifier and the EQ to have enough output capability so that the limit of both the drive unit movement and the amplifier voltage limit run out at about the same time.
Got it. DTLA guy in the chat room is asking, and you already answered this, is the high pass filter configurable? And the answer is no, you already did that work, right?
Correct. It's not configurable, nor is the phase response or the frequency response of the subwoofer, because those are the areas where I try and do the blending directly. Mm-hmm. The only thing you can adjust is the subwoofer level to compensate for where in the room it is. You know, have you put it into a corner? Is it behind you? Is it further away?
Right.
You actually like lots of bass. Okay, then you can turn up the level. But the blending, as I say, it's very critical doing that blending. And you have to take into account, as the subwoofer will maybe be used at different distances relative to the speaker bar, what is the energy transition between the two? Often when we look at crossover slopes, like let's say a typical Linkwitz-Riley fourth order, that's the THX spec. But that's not actually a transition that gives a flat power response blend between the drivers.
By the way, before we continue, let's make sure everyone understands Linkwitz-Riley fourth order.
Okay, it's a class of crossover filter. So you'll roll off at fourth order from the low pass and fourth order from the high pass.
And fourth order means a particular slope. It
rolling
means
a foot, 24
it rolls
dB.
Off 24 dB per octave is very steep.
Yes, it's one of the steepest you'll get in a passive system, typically. There are exceptions, but that's generally the rule, that you very rarely in a passive system go beyond that. But of course, this is an active system and the rules are different there, which I can get into in a moment.
Yes.
But a Linkwitz-Riley does not give a flat power transfer response between the low pass and the high pass. That's okay between a mid-range and a tweeter, but it's really not okay between a subwoofer and the mid-bass. So I go for more of a phase quadrature alignment, but I go in this for sixth-order slopes.
Sixth-order slopes, which is, what, 48, 96 dB per octave?
It's 48.
48.
Yeah.
So that's
every
pretty steep.
Is six.
It's every order steep. Is six, okay.
Because it's an active filter and it's a digital filter. So I could perhaps have gone for even higher if I wanted to by just adding in functions within the DSP. But I determined that was sufficient. And it's something you can very readily do with DSP. You can give it mathematically exactly the function that you want. It doesn't have to be a classical filter function, and I almost never use a classical filter function. I do the filter function that does the job I need. It compensates for the drive units also. And the advantage of it being in DSP is that it's exactly reproducible. So every filter in every product is exactly the same. You don't have the tolerances involved when you're doing a passive filter or conventional analog active filter.
Using resistors and capacitors and inductors and so on, they all have tolerances in their values of what they do. And so when you put one together, it might behave a little differently than the next one with the same parts.
That's right. And one of the problems with tolerances is how you deal with tolerances in manufacture. So especially for the drive units, I try and design my drive units at these price points to be least sensitive to production variations. You design the magnet systems, the voice coil lengths, and everything to try and take out that from the equation to maintain manufacturing consistency. With crossovers, one of the common ways of dealing with that is to simply select 1% or 2% tolerance components in your expensive networks. Then as you come down in price, you go to 5% or 10% tolerance components. In fact, in my previous life, what we used to do is we would measure every single component that came in, sort them into 1% bands, but not just select out the 1% and throw away all the others. We would actually mix and match. We'd re-optimize the networks and have this mapping procedure so that you could, say, take a plus 1% capacitor with a minus 2% inductor and a plus 4% resistor and get back to almost exactly the nominal response. And you just produce these big charts and you'd be able to use, you could buy in components that were cheap at 20% tolerance, sort them into bands and then mix and match them and make best use and still get very tight tolerances.
Wow, that's incredible, actually. That would be very time intensive and thus very expensive, though, right?
It was actually less time intensive than, or less expensive than purchasing at 1% tolerance.
Interesting.
Yeah, and some of the components, the manufacturers would not supply you them at 1% tolerance. So
right.
There was no option sometimes. But with digital filters, you don't have that problem.
Yeah. In my one of my past lives, I had a summer job as a quality control inspector, and I was looking at physical parts, screws and nuts and bolts and stuff. And they had to fit within certain tolerances too. So I understand what you're talking about and how tedious it is to go through a box of components and test each one and, you know, accept or reject or sort into different boxes. Ugh, I wouldn't want that job.
No. You give that to the intern.
Yeah, right. Exactly so. Exactly so. Well, we've got a lot more to talk about, but before we do, I would like to take a moment to thank one of our sponsors for this episode, which is Ting.com. Ting is a no BS mobile service. They're basically a reseller of the nationwide Sprint network. Now, how is Ting different? Well, they have no contracts or early termination fees, I should say. It's very straightforward. No bundling, no ride-along services. You can choose from XS or XXL service levels for voice minutes, text messages, and megabytes of data, all billed separately. There are no overage charges or penalties. You use more than you bought. You thought you would. Just pay for what you used. There's no add-on charges, no mysterious line items on your bill. Everything's very upfront. There are unlimited devices on one plan. You can have as many as you want. On the one plan, sharing pooled minutes, messages, and megabytes, each device on the plan costs a flat $6 a month. There's also a powerful online account control panel. You can take control of your account, your usage, and bills. And no holds barred customer support. You can call 1-855-TING-FTW anytime between 8 a.m. and 8 p.m. Eastern time, and a real person will pick up the phone. How about that? There's excellent online support as well at help.ting.com with active customer forums, simple and powerful ticketing system, video tutorials, startup guides, and much more. How it works is you purchase your mobile device from Ting, which you'll receive in 2 to 5 business days. Then you activate your device with Ting and have the option to select a new phone number or port an existing one. Ting will break your rate out by minutes, text messages, and megabytes and bill you at the end of the month for what you've used. Visit Ting today at htg.ting.com. Save money and better manage your mobile phone usage with Ting. Check out their savings calculator and see how much you or your company can save. Home Theater Geeks viewers also save $25 on your first Ting device when you sign up. So visit htg.ting.com and start saving today. And we thank Ting very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire TWiT network. Okay, Andrew, we're talking about the SP-SB23W speaker bar, pardon me, from Pioneer. And we started to talk a little bit about the enclosure, and I wanted you to give me a little bit more information about that. There are some pretty special things about this enclosure, aren't there?
Yes, there are. We decided to go with the same construction method as we do with the bookshelves and the towers, and that is, first of all, wood and curved wood. So it's made with the same RF bent or RF molded and laminated MDF that we use in the bookshelves.
Now, this is very interesting. Before you go on, RF molded, you're using radio frequencies somehow to actually bend this, I guess it's laminated, multi-layer, would you call it plywood?
Not plywood, but MDF. So it's thin sheets of MDF, maybe 1/8 inch thick. You laminate them up, you glue them together, just like you would glue plywood, but it's MDF rather than plywood. You then put those between two molds, which are curved molds, and you apply essentially a microwave field between or through the wood, and it heats up the glue joints. Then you close the mold, and it presses the wood into a curve. You take away the RF field, the glue resets, and now you're left with a permanently curved laminated piece of MDF. The low-cost way of making curved MDF panels is what's called kerf cutting, where you take a flat, solid sheet of MDF and you just run lots of parallel saw cuts almost all the way through it, say for the last millimeter or so. Those cuts take away your material, so you can then start to just bend the wood around, and you run glue in all those slots, bend the wood, let the glue set, and then you've got a curved panel. But there's always a witness, because it's a, let's say, a stepwise approximation to a curve, so it's not a true curve, and you can sometimes see that witnessing on the outside of the cabinet. And also, the glue is never as strong as the MDF that you took away, so the panel, although curved, doesn't have what you think of as the traditional benefits of a curved panel being stiffer. So we chose not to go that route. We chose the same processes we use for the bookshelves and the towers. But we did that rather than making it of plastic. Nearly every other speaker bar or sound bar on the market is made with plastic. Now, I certainly didn't make my bookshelf speakers of plastic. That's a good reason for that. Right. Some of the subwoofers on the market for these soundbar type products are made of plastic. Yikes. You know, plastic was never a good material to make a speaker from, which is why...
Why is that? Why is plastic not a good material to make speaker cabinets from?
In the typical thicknesses that most injection molded cabinets use, it's very resonant. And the whole point of a cabinet is you don't want it to be resonating and coloring the sound of the music. The only thing that should be producing the sound is the drive unit. The cabinet should be inert. Now, of course, there's levels of inertness. There's very few cabinets that are truly inert until you get to the very high end of speakers, but that costs a lot of money. At the low end, you're doing everything you can do to minimize the effects of the cabinet. And plastic is never your first choice. So we chose to go with the wood and make a sound bar, let's say a speaker bar, that has that wooden construction to get the best sound or no sound out of the cabinet as we could get.
So the bending technique that you use, this RF heating and bending molding, results in, well, first of all, using wood or MDF results in a stiffer, less resonant cabinet. And using this bending technique rather than the cutting technique you were describing earlier also results in a stiffer, less resonant cabinet. Have I got that right?
Exactly. That's right. Yes.
Okay. And isn't it more expensive, though, to do it this way? I mean, isn't that why people use plastic? Because it's less expensive?
In the limit, yes. It can be, other than the costs of creating the tools to make the molding, which can, with such large molding, can be very expensive. Ultimately, over a long production run, it can be more cost-effective. But I didn't want to do. I said before that I have project manager Chris Walker. He holds me down and stops me spending. Tries to be successful, but you know there are limits. And a product of it like this, same with the speaker bar, bookshelves, is we're trying to optimize the performance within a cost constraint. How do I spend my money to get the overall optimum result? Well, part of that had to be the cabinet. The cabinet is a big contributor, if done wrong, to the sound of the system, and I wanted to definitely use the same technique I've used in the bookshelves. So you can see the drive units have got, they look almost identical to what's in the bookshelf. The cabinet looks almost identical. So you can pick up to say, ah, there's something different about this soundbar. It looks like it belongs in the family. It ought to sound like it belongs in the family. You know, of course, that was my philosophy in what sound do I get from it. It has to have that same family of sound that I've already provided with the other speakers.
And the curved sides of the cabinet, what advantage does that convey?
Well, curving the cabinet can help stiffen the panel. Just like any panel in a car or whatever, a complex curve will always push the resonances up higher than a simple flat. It's like we use cones rather than flat discs for a speaker drive unit. The cone adds an extra degree of stiffness over and above a flat panel.
I hadn't thought of that before. That's interesting.
And, of course, from a styling point of view, it gives some extra shape rather than being a square box. In the limit, maybe can alter the internal standing waves a bit, but that's a very, very minor factor. It's mostly
I was sorry for interrupting, but I would have thought that the curved sides would have played a much more important role in reducing the resonances within the cabinet, but you're saying no.
Well, I'm saying the internal acoustic resonances.
That's what I mean, yeah.
Yeah. When you examine what is the cause of cabinet coloration, by far the major factor is the vibration of the cabinet, and the excitation source of that vibration is not acoustic pressure within the box. Unless you're talking about a subwoofer where you've got a small box with a huge drive unit in, it's really pressurizing the air inside the cabinet. But at most of the frequencies where the cabinet will go into resonant modes, that is caused by mechanical reaction force, just like with a rifle. When you fire a rifle, bullet goes one way, you get recoil. Same thing happens with a drive unit. The cone gets fired outwards, the magnet tries to push backwards with equal force, and it's constrained by the cabinet, but that energy is going into the cabinet. And it's that force, it's more than 100 times stronger at those frequencies than the acoustic pressure force that's within the cabinet. So the major form of cabinet coloration is mechanical, not acoustical.
Wow. Well, I learned something today, and one reason I love doing this show is because I always learn something. So that's fantastic. Got a couple questions here for you. SoCal Ray Jr. in the chat room is asking, how big was the demo room that he and I and about 15 other AVS forum members heard this soundbar in?
Maybe I should turn my camera around and show you.
Oh, there you go. Okay, if you can do that.
No, I think from memory it's about 17 feet wide and 24 feet long and 10 feet high. So it's a good size.
It's a good size, but a typical size for a good size room in a home.
Yes, yes. It's not the smallest, it's not the biggest. It's
yeah, kind of exactly. Terry Kay is asking, in finalizing your designs, do you use listener panels or just rely on your own golden ears?
I don't know, one from Pioneers listening, I could say, they've all got bad hearing, so it's just me. Sorry, guys. No, I always get other opinions, but mostly it's my decision. Certainly the ultimate decision is mine. I will involve other people in listening just as a check, but it's down to me ultimately.
Mm-hmm. Superu in the chat room is asking if there's a sample available to show us. Do you happen to have one sitting there?
Yes, I actually have. I don't know how this is going to show. So,
Put it upwards a little bit.
There you go.
So the two drive units, I've got it upside down, of course. The two drive units.
The two Archer drive units and the tweeter there on the outside.
Let me turn it right way up and at least. So control panel in the middle.
Yep.
And so the length is 36 inches. Obviously the tweeter's on the outside. Twin mid-bass drivers in the middle. And then on the back, we've got the amplifier built-in analog RCA inputs and also optical inputs. The amplifier, this is an example of the amplifier here. Sorry.
Move it into the
reversed field in the, a little bit. There.
Yeah, I understand. So okay, so there's a picture of the electronics.
Yeah, so each of these are the outputs to each of the six drive units. So there's six channels of amplification, 28 watts per channel, inbuilt power supply. So there's no wall wart. Everything is built inside. And then this connector is through to the control panel in the front.
Right. This brings us to F-Loop's question in the chat room, which is the marketing material seemed to say that the SPSB23W has an, quote, 8-channel active digital crossover network. But we only have 6 drivers, and then there's the subwoofer. So how do we reconcile these numbers?
On the chip, there's 8 channels of independent DSP, so you can do all sorts of filtering and funny stuff. But the actual output to the drivers is 6 channels for the speaker bar, then there's 1 channel for the subwoofer. So there's just kind of one that's not utilized fully
in
terms of DSP. But think about it. The speaker bar is 6 channels, but with a subwoofer, you've got a 7-channel system. And you want to take left and right and filter them and add them together. So that's why we utilize all 8 channels of DSP.
Mm-hmm. Well, this brings me to the next question I wanted to talk about, which is the internal electronics. You mentioned that each driver of the 6 in the speaker bar, gets, what'd you say, 28 watts of power?
Yes.
And then there is DSP, digital signal processing, which we were talking about earlier in terms of providing the crossover to the subwoofer, the filter that removes the low frequencies from getting to the drivers within the speaker bar and passes them on to the subwoofer. But there are some other things that DSP does as well, aren't there?
Well, as usual, the function of a crossover is both to keep out-of-band signals away from the drivers that don't want it. So mid-bass drivers, you don't want anything getting in below 110 hertz. Tweeter, obviously, you don't want anything below around 2 or 3K getting into the tweeter. But then you've got equalization. Drive units aren't perfect. Once you put them into a cabinet, you get diffraction effects that alter their response. So the job of the DSP or any crossover function actually is to both filter and equalize the drivers to get the system response that you want. So it's a combination. So the DSP both has the ability to give you the very high order crossovers, and I do that for reasons particularly with a speaker bar, which is a horizontal array of drive units. You know, always my more expensive speaker designs always tend to be concentric drivers. And I do that for a good reason. They're very good off-axis. They interface with the room very well. They give very good stereo imaging. Space drivers are never quite as good. And with regular speaker systems, we try and minimize that effect by having a vertical array of drive units. But of course, every center channel or every soundbar has to have a horizontal array of drive units because we want something very thin height-wise but very wide width-wise. So the drivers are side by side. That's not really what you want to do. That worsens the problem of off-axis response because of the interaction between the drive units.
It also results in something sometimes called comb filtering, right, where this interaction between the drivers, as you move side to side, you might get into an area that in which some frequencies are destructively interfered with each other and some in which they're constructively interfered. So you get this kind of uneven response.
Exactly. You've got two effects. You've got that interference effect, which gives destructive or additive interference. You've also got different directivity patterns, typically. So the amount of energy emitted off to the sides of one drive unit does not match what the next driver does as you transition through crossover. So I've used the waveguides around the tweeter. I do that to match the directivity of the tweeter to the mid-range. So I solve partially the problem. But by going to high-order filters, I can restrict the range over which that interference effects occur to a very narrow region. Passive filters, typically, I said fourth order is typically the highest that you do. In an entry-level speaker, the electrical order is typically no more than second. And depending on what your drive units can do acoustically, it might reach third or fourth. But it's very much less than what you can do with a DSP crossover. So it minimizes the range of which you get that constructive and destructive interference between the drive units. And also I can, because I've got a horizontal array of two mid-bass drivers, and again, they will have their own interference effects, never mind how they cross over to the tweeter, they'll also have their own interference effects with each other. I put an all-pass network into a special shape into one of the drivers, and that further improves the off-axis performance. And that's something you can only do practically with a DSP type crossover. So I've done a lot of fiddling, let's say, with the DSP filter functions to overcome the traditional effects of horizontally arrayed drive units and get closer to what I might be able to achieve if they were concentric drivers.
Mm-hmm. And also you've included in this speaker bar several presets that serve different functions. Tell us a bit about those.
Yes, these are fairly straightforward concepts that we have a music mode. So this is where I've designed the blending of the subwoofer to the speaker bar and the smoothness of response of the subwoofer so that I get the best sound possible with music. So this is equivalent of taking the BS-22 bookshelf speakers with an amplifier as a stereo system. This is the sound I've targeted in music mode with the speaker bar. Now, of course, the difference is it has the included subwoofer, which is self-powered and wireless, which we can go to.
We'll get to that in a minute. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. But basically, in some respects, it can outperform what the BS-22s with, let's say, an A20 amplifier can do, because it can play down lower in the bass and louder because it has a dedicated subwoofer. But tonality and overall presentation of music, that was my target. Match what the BS-22s in a well-set-up stereo system can do. Then there's movie mode. Now, movie mode is you want lots of bass. you want the earth to shake. You want the explosions to pump your chest. Right. Now, I can't quite achieve all of that with the capability of the subwoofer that we have, although it does pretty well for its size and price point. But I've altered the shape of response of the subwoofer and the default level of the subwoofer so that with movies, you get that more dramatic presentation. But of course, it's not automatic, so you choose to put it into movie mode or music mode. So it's adjust to taste. You can also, from the remote control, adjust volume up and volume down to set it to where you want it to be. Mm-hmm. And then there's dialogue mode. Dialogue mode is where you want to do, let's say, afternoon listening to a talk show, chat show, or late night listening. You don't really need the subwoofer, but if the subwoofer is engaged, it's surprising how even on chat shows, there's lots of rumbles and all sorts of low frequency noises. They're just going to annoy the neighbors. And so because the speaker bar crosses over so low, what I basically do is mute the subwoofer in that mode. Mm. And the sound of the speaker bar by itself is still very enjoyable in that mode for that kind of presentation. Even on music, it does a respectable job because I did cross down lower than most sound bars do.
Mm-hmm.
But it avoids that. It's always the low frequencies that get through to the next door house or condominium. And so that's what I wanted to avoid.
I can also imagine, I get a number of questions from people who are hard of hearing and want to, and can't quite get the dialogue very often. I imagine that that mode might be useful for them as well.
It does. One of the things about dialogue is if you have too much bass, you get a masking. Whenever you get large low frequency content, it will mask the audibility of the voices. So it's twofold. It annoys the neighbors less, but by removing that low frequency content, the dialogue comes through much more clearly. You don't have to artificially boost the mid range to make that intelligibility come forward.
Right.
Just the removal of low frequencies will remove the masking effects and make it sound clearer.
Mm, very good. Very good. One more quick question before we get to the soundbar. Some people have asked me if this, I'm sorry, before we get to the subwoofer. Yes. Some people have asked me if this speaker bar is 2.1, 3.1. Does it do surround simulation as many of these products do?
It's a 2.1. I did that for some deliberate reasons. For the width of this class of product, 36 inches, I experimented with what would happen if you remove a dedicated center speaker from that. And I found that not much. There's still, even when you're sitting off axis, the sound still pretty much centralizes between the two speakers. You don't feel that it, with a regular stereo system, if you used it for movies and you put the speakers the typical distance apart that they would be in a stereo system, you'll definitely notice it will just collapse one way or the other. But with this product, it doesn't. Yes, it moves a bit, but it's not a dramatic collapse. You still get the impression that the sound is coming from, you know, reasonably centered on the TV. And to incorporate a dedicated center channel squeezed in there, I'd have had to reduce the amplifier. I need more amplifiers, more drive units to maintain the cost. The quality of everything would have gone down. And I determined that that was not a worthwhile option. I get much better sound quality and overall satisfactory performance by going to a 2.1 system. Again, with trying to generate surround sound effects, some of the DSP chips that you get that are made available for this kind of product, they even have inbuilt spatializer modes. I listen to them and after a couple of seconds, okay, not using that one. It seemed all detrimental to me. Now, maybe partially on some movies, if you're sat dead center, you can get some spatialization. But this is the problem. Nearly every spatializer relies on some kind of head-related transfer function process.
Yep.
And that means you have to be centered. All the other ones work by trying to bounce sound off nearby reflective surfaces. Well,
yep.
If you don't have those surfaces, it's not doing anything. So I determined, let's make the best 2.1 system at an entry-level price point. So when you turn it on and listen to movies and listen to music, you go, wow, I didn't think, again, this was possible at this price point. That was my criteria. All this extra little things maybe can come later or in a higher priced product. But at this price point, I wanted to make what I considered the best overall performance at the price point, and that meant the 2.1 system.
Very good. Well, now is time soon to talk about the subwoofer, but before we do, I'd like to take a moment to thank our other sponsor for this episode, which is ProXPN. Now, ProXPN is a virtual private network that works with almost any internet connection. It creates a secure, encrypted tunnel through which all of your online data passes back and forth. Any online application can work with ProXPN, including your web browser, email, file sharing, and instant messaging programs. ProXPN keeps everything you do online hidden from prying eyes. And what could be more important in these days of NSA spying? It even disguises your physical location and gives you unfettered access to any website or online service, no matter where you live or travel to. It uses 512-bit encryption, which should be pretty secure, I would think. Works over OpenVPN or PPTP, you choose. You can protect yourself against your ISP's six strikes rule and keep your personal internet usage private at work. That's very important. You can bypass internet filtering and blocked websites, bypass geographical restrictions for internet content and online video with worldwide servers in the US, UK, Asia, and more. In fact, ProXPN makes your internet connection truly region-free. There's software available for Mac and Windows that offers advanced control, allowing you to select the programs and ports you want to anonymously route through ProXPN servers. It also works with your iOS and Android device, allowing you to use your data plan or public corporate Wi-Fi with complete and total privacy. No app required. There's world-class customer support. Steve Gibson even gave it a great review on Security Now right here on the TWIT network. Go to proxpn.com/twit for more information and to sign up. ProXPN premium accounts are normally $9.95 a month or $74.95 for an entire year, but we've got a special offer. Use the code HTG and receive 20% off for the lifetime of your account. That's less than $5 a month on the yearly plan. If you're not satisfied, you can cancel within 7 days for a full refund. So go to proxpn.com/twit and sign up with the code HTG. And we thank ProXPN very much for their support of Home Theater Geeks and the entire TWIT network. Okay, let's turn our attention now to the subwoofer, which comes with the speaker bar. It's a total package. Tell us the basic specs and everything about the subwoofer that comes with.
Yeah, so the subwoofer, first of all, it's wireless. And we did that for ease of placement. You don't have to run a cable from the speaker bar to the subwoofer.
And by the way, what wireless frequency does it operate on?
I think it's 2.4. 2.4 gig. Uh-huh. Yeah, so the standard one. It's not a Bluetooth connection. It's a wireless connection. The speaker bar has Bluetooth connectivity, and it has aptX. So you can use a phone or a tablet to stream music directly to the speaker bar. So again, it's a sound system beyond just being a sound bar. It's a speaker bar for music and your TV. But the subwoofer is 2.4 gig wireless, and as I say, it gives you that ease of connectivity. Just plug it into the nearest power outlet. Typically, the wireless connectivity to subwoofers has a delay built in because of all the processing that it uses. So I've compensated for that delay by adding extra delay into the speaker bar so that now the subwoofer and the speaker bar are back in sync.
But doesn't that introduce some delay between the audio and the video?
Yes, but what I've done is made sure that I kept that below the threshold of audibility for lip sync.
Ah.
So I think
around 10 milliseconds, if I'm not
it's
right.
Actually, it depends. The research that I've looked at says up to about 20 milliseconds for an untrained listener, mm-hmm. and down to about 14 or 15 for a trained listener. So I've kept it below that.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And so it's a 50 watt per channel amplifier. Built in.
There's only one channel in the subwoofer, right?
Exactly. Yes.
So a 50 watt amplifier there.
50 watt amplifier, a 6.5-inch bass driver. Now, of course, a lot of people say 6.5-inch bass driver. That's a woofer. That's not a subwoofer.
Well, right.
Okay. Semantics. It's you know, what frequency range are you operating it over? No, it won't go as loud as an 8-inch or 10-inch or 12-inch or 15-inch subwoofer. It's commensurate with the class and price point of this product, but most people who've heard it have gone, that's only 6.5-inch driver. Mm-hmm. You know, I think there's an issue here, and I've fought this almost my whole audio life of marketing specs versus engineering specs.
Yes.
Subwoofers, the better subwoofer must be the bigger driver and the bigger amplifier. So 50 watts and 6 inch, 80 watts and 8 inch, 120 watts and 10 inch, 200 watts and 12 inch, and so on and so on. And it's not necessarily true. You can, obviously, within the laws of physics, you can play around with magnet size and EQ and impedance and whatever and get good performance out of smaller drivers. But yes, it's still, it has a limited performance, but it's a surprising performance for the size of the subwoofer.
So what do you spec as its, or what is realistically its lower, its low frequency extension down to?
I think it's somewhere around 45, 46 is the low frequency limit, which is not admittedly true subwoofer performance, but it's respectable to give you that extra depth that you need for most music and even movies, again, for the price point.
Yeah, exactly. And we've been talking about the price point. Tell us what that is.
It's $399. So
okay, so $400 for this speaker bar and subwoofer, which is wireless, and if I'm not mistaken, it's very simple. You just, as you say, plug it into the nearest wall outlet to place it where it will do the most good.
And yeah, it comes with integral wall brackets. So if your TV is wall mounted, you can put it directly underneath the TV. If the TV is just stood on a surface, there's some rubber feet, and you can just stand it on top of there.
The connection between the two, the speaker bar and the subwoofer, very simple. You just turn it on and it automatically links up, right?
Yes. The first time you got to go through a syncing procedure, hold down a button until the light blinks on the speaker bar. Okay. Hold down the button until it blinks on the subwoofer, and then they'll see each other. Nothing else to do. They're now paired. Even if you subsequently turn it off and turn it on again, it'll always automatically repair. Then one connection from the TV. This is intended for people who don't already have a home theater system, or they want it, let's say, in the bedroom. So it's one connection from the TV, either optical, if your TV has audio outputting from the optical output. You have to watch for that. Some HDMI inputs won't provide digital audio through to the optical out because of copyright limitations. Or you have analog RCA out. Either method, just plug that into the back of the satellite, wirelessly connect the subwoofer, and you're done. Everything that was working before now continues to work, but you get better sound.
Right. Sorry, go ahead.
It comes with its own remote control, but it's also got a learning capability. So any remote control that you have, pretty much, obviously infrared, not wireless, pretty much any of them can, the soundbar can learn their control codes easily. You just press a button, blinks. Fairly simple process. Mm-hmm. And then you can map any functionality from the front panel of the speaker bar or its remote control onto your favorite remote control. For example, power. So when you turn on your power to the TV, it'll also turn on the power to the speaker bar. When you turn TV volume up and down from the remote, it'll turn the sound level up and down on the speaker bar.
Mm-hmm.
We wanted to give that easy functionality.
Yeah. That easy functionality reminds me of one of the things that I want to make sure everybody understands, which is, as you said before, this is meant to replace the sound coming from the TV's tiny little funky speakers and is not intended to be used with an AV receiver type system. And therefore, your source devices, your Blu-ray player, your game console, your cable or satellite box, they all connect. Your intention is for them to connect to the TV directly by HDMI, primarily, and then having the audio come out of the TV either by digital, optical digital, which most TVs have, or by analog stereo with the red and white RCA outputs going into the soundbar and using the system like that.
Exactly. What we want is that whatever system, if you don't already have a home theater receiver, everything's already plumbed in through your TV.
Yes.
So all we're doing is with one extra connection, you now have better sound. we deliberately didn't put in things like HDMI connectivity from the speaker bar, because what's the point? You don't want to start replumbing. You just take this home, one connection, and you're done. And you're using the same remote controls that you have, so there's no learning function in order to operate this system. That's for when you're using a receiver and all the complexity involved with that.
This is those of us who have a receiver know the complexity there for sure.
It's the simple solutions. That's exactly, you know, we didn't use that name again, but the functionality is it's a simple solution to getting better sound from your TV.
Right. And another reason that occurred to me why a 2.1 system was reasonable in this application is that even if you have multi-channel coming in by HDMI, you have 5.1 or 7.1 or whatever, if the TV allows the digital audio output to go out at all, most often it's in a 2.1 or a two-channel format anyway. They've mixed it down to two channels. You don't normally get multi-channel coming out of a TV.
Exactly. You don't. It's already been pre-mixed down to two-channel. If it doesn't, we have Dolby digital decoding built in. So we can take the full 5.1 stream or 7.1 stream and decode that and mix that down internally to 2.1. So it can work in either mode.
Oh, that's good to know. I'm not sure I knew that before, but that's great. So you have a Dolby digital decoder, DTS as well?
No, just Dolby digital.
Mm-hmm. Which is most likely what's going to come out of the TV, if at all.
Exactly, and it's what's going to come out of your cable box.
Right, exactly. Somebody in the chat room is asking, where's the website for this soundbar? And it's certainly something I would have promoted at the end of the show anyway. PioneerElectronics.com, right?
Yes, and I think it's on our opening page. It's certainly heading up the home electronics part of it. So it's easy to find on the PioneerElectronics.com website.
Now, it's not currently available, right? I mean, you can't actually go out and buy it at this point?
No, it's we've just started manufacture about a week and a half, 2 weeks ago. The first ones are on the sea as we speak. And oh, there you go. And it will be in the stores by mid to late September.
Mid to late September. Okay. Yes. I've been telling everybody the end of this month, so it's a little bit delayed from that. But I do know that a lot of people are anticipating this with great eagerness. So I'm looking forward to checking it out myself. Like I said, I've heard it. A number of people have heard it down at Pioneer, and I was certainly extremely impressed. So I'm looking forward very much to checking it out at a greater length. A couple of people in the chat room are saying, is it an international version or U.S. only? Luis is asking, is there any chance of getting these in Europe?
Actually, I believe the power supply, it's a universal power supply, so it will run on any voltage. Initially, this is one of our U.S. source speaker projects, so it's designed primarily for the U.S., but it is also going into Canada and Mexico and other parts of South America. As yet, I don't know what's happening with what we'll do for distribution in Europe. We're sending out samples for all our subsidiaries to listen to. And just like the other speakers did, other groups in other parts of the world did choose to sell the other speakers. But of course, this is a powered one and it's wireless. So it's a different process. In order to sell to some of the countries, you've got to make sure it's got the verifications for both the wireless operation and the safety around the world. And so right now, it's primarily intended for North and South America.
Got it. Nerve is asking what the model number is, and Beatmaster already answered. The SP-SB23W.
Yes, I'm finally beginning to remember that.
Yes, I do understand that problem. I have to keep in mind so many model numbers that it is kind of hard sometimes.
Yeah.
Arthur D is asking, why did Pioneer discontinue the 5.25-inch bookshelf speakers?
Oh,
not sure what he's referring to there.
So when we did the original version of the bookshelves, we had two models, the BS 21 and the BS 41. So the 21 was the 4-inch version, the 41 was the 5-inch version. And it just comes down to distribution. There wasn't as much demand for the 41. When we design stuff, we want to make sure that we've got a good enough market for it in order to maintain these price points.
Sure.
As manufacturing quantity goes down, the price has to go up. So when we came to design the second series, the 22 and the 52, we dropped the 42 because there hadn't been quite the demand for it. But I knew that going into that rework. So I tried to get closer in the improvement of the sound of the 22. I tried to get it closer to the capability that we'd originally had from the 41 to give better bass extension and a bit more dynamic bass performance from the 4-inch version.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very cool. Well, thank you so much for being with us. Andrew Jones, Director of Speaker, Loudspeaker Technology, Loudspeaker Design, I guess is the official title, right?
I make up different titles depending on my mood.
Okay, very good. Anyway, with Pioneer Electronics talking about the new speaker bar, SP-SB23W, I think we'll get that by now, which will be available.
It's the only one we make, so just call
it the only one. Yes, exactly. So it's hard, and it's not hard to find, which will be available in early to mid to late September sometime. Fantastic. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure. I enjoyed it once again.
Yes, thank you. Of course, as we said, you can find more information about the speaker bar that we've been talking about at pioneerelectronics.com. You can find me, of course, at avsforum.com. You can email me at scott@twit.tv. And you can follow me on Twitter at htgeekscott, also at avsforum, where we have quite a lively Twitter feed going on right now. You can find previous episodes of Home Theater Geeks right here on twit.tv/HTG or on its YouTube channel, youtube.com/twithometheatergeeks. Next week, my guest geeks are scheduled to be Barb Gonzalez and Mark Henninger, both of whom now have the Google Chromecast, the little USB dongle device that is poised to be the next step in living room TV streaming. And they're going to give us their report about how they've found it in actual use. So I do hope you will join me for that. Until then, geek out.